funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do Julia Roberts, Bill Gates, and the Dalai Lama have in common? In addition to being world famous for their respective achievements, they all grew up as middle children in their families. Wouldn't Jan Brady be surprised? As it turns out, while the Jan Brady view of middle child status is common, it is, like Jan herself, the product largely of fiction. In fact, as my guest today has discovered through years of research, growing up between the oldest and youngest child in a family has some distinct advantages and provides many middle children with a skill set remarkably useful in business, law, even marriage. Catherine Salmon is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Redlands in California and co-author of The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. The book is now available in paperback. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So start with this. Why are there so many persistent myths about all those poor middle children out there?
I think there's a number of reasons. I think one actually that's fairly relevant is actually the media, that when you see middleborns presented in the media, they're often presented as being sort of bitter or resentful of their position in the family. And I think that part of what's happened in terms of people's perceptions comes simply from things like that. We actually, you know, get a lot of information about everything, actually, from the media. And a lot of times it can be accurate, but a lot of times it can be an exaggeration. And so I think that that's one sort of large place where we've gotten that idea. And I think sometimes we also get the idea because some middleborns are resentful. And I think the other thing is that they are neglected in a sense, that they do get less attention. And so it's not that that is necessarily, you know, that aspect of things is necessarily inaccurate. The idea that it actually has some great long-lasting negative effect on them is the part that's incorrect.
Yeah, so there is that sort of benign neglect. It's not that their parents necessarily love them less, but they maybe spend fewer resources, a little bit less time. You find that middles sometimes develop an enhanced sort of independence.
Right. I mean, that is actually the big benefit in some sense to being a middle child that we talk about, especially in the sort of modern world where often parents overparent their children and don't give them a lot of independence. And you know, for a variety of different reasons, parents tend to have more control over what their kids are doing, more supervision over what their kids are doing. I mean, I teach at a university. I've got students that are on their cell phones to their parents talking about what classes they should take and things like that. And by the time kids are that age, they should have developed a good sense of independence. They're going to be adults going out into the world. And I think that middleborns, in a sense, are better prepared for that because they have had less attention from their parents. They have been, to a certain extent, overlooked in some ways. And because of that, they've had to, you know, foster their own sort of drive and ambition to get the things that they want and they need. And that serves them really well then once they actually leave the family.
And just to be clear, middleborns in larger families are not just the ones who are dead center, but anybody who is not the oldest and not the youngest.
Right. That really, when you think about families and family size and birth order, you have a firstborn that anchors it, you have a lastborn, and then, of course, you can also have an only child. But middles are any of the ones that fall between the first and the last. And so in a family of five, you actually have three middleborn children.
So, Catherine, as a parent and as a sibling myself, I love birth order research, but I have to ask this. I mean, how significant is the impact of birth order as compared with, say, inherent temperament or the style of parenting that children are exposed to?
Sure. All of those things interact. I mean, and that's one of the things that I think often gets missed when we talk about things, because most people focus on one particular aspect and how that affects people's development and people's personality and things like that. And so, you know, you might have somebody like me that might focus more on the impact of birth order and family size, and then you might have somebody else who focuses on the genetics of personality and how much that influences it. They all influence it. And in some ways, to a pretty equal extent, that in fact, you know, there's a significant proportion of personality that is due to genetics. There's a significant proportion of personality that's due to birth order. And there's also some percentage of personality that's due to, you know, other factors as well. And that can be influenced by things like peers and stuff like that. And so, of course, parenting style can play a part as well. Although even when you think about it in terms of parenting style, we usually classify and say, well, the parent is authoritarian or authoritative or whatever type of parenting style. but they don't necessarily parent all of their children exactly the same either. Mm. And I think that that's one of the things that I think birth order researchers often want to remind people of, is that we often think of the family as shared environment, because we talk about non-shared environmental effects and shared environmental effects. Well, theoretically, the family should be a shared effect, but it's not really, because a firstborn doesn't experience their family in exactly the same way as the baby of the family does with a middle child.
Hmm. So talk about this. How middle children make up for a bit less of their parents' attention and resources often is by relying more heavily on their peer group than, mm-hmm. than other kids.
Yes, and that's a pro and a con mm-hmm. in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the pro parts of that is that it makes them very skilled at dealing with other people. They develop sense of empathy, their good understanding of what other people want and what they need to do to get other people to do what they want them to do. And so they become really good at negotiation. They become often in many ways very, very friendship oriented. And so they often are really good at maintaining friendships, great friends, develop great friendships. And they often bring those skills into romantic relationships as well. And so there's a great benefit to it from that perspective. The downside is that it depends on who their peer group is.
Yeah.
And so sometimes if a middle child's particular, that particular child's peer group tends to be one that gets into more trouble, they're more likely to experiment with drugs, things like that, then that risk is there for the middle child too. And I think that's one of the reasons that some studies that have been done in the past that have looked at the effect of birth order on things like delinquency and things like that. It's not that middle children are inherently more likely to experience that kind of problem, but they're more likely to value their peers enough to, perhaps try what their peers are trying.
So if I interpreted this correctly, middle children do tend to have a slightly lower self-esteem as kids, but mm-hmm. that vanishes by the time they're adults.
It usually disappears by the time they're adults. It doesn't mean that in every case it does, mm-hmm. and certainly I've talked to middle children who are adults who have self-esteem issues. One of the things that I think is kind of interesting when we look at self-esteem and success and self-esteem and, in children, there actually isn't a really good correlation between self-esteem and success in life, like in terms of, school, occupations, things like that. But we worry about it a lot, right? We're always saying, you need to build kids' self-esteem. You've got to make them feel better about themselves. Well, one of the things I think that people forget is that self-esteem is supposed to, in a sense, be kind of a reflection of how other people see you and your sort of place in the sort of social setting. And so when people give you lots of positive reinforcement, you feel like you're a valuable member of the group. And that tells you what you need to do or don't need to do in terms of your own behavior. And I think sometimes when we give individuals false self-esteem, pump it up when it's not necessarily deserved, we're not doing them any favors because they're not actually learning what they need to do and not do to be part of the group. And so I think for middles, the fact that they tend to have a little bit lower self-esteem might actually be a good thing for them. They're not likely to be overinflated in mm-hmm. terms of their perception of how they fit into the group. So they may work a little bit harder than they need to be valued by others. But on the other hand, that's probably a better position to be in than the person who doesn't actually put enough into things because they think they're all that in a bag of chips.
Yeah, so middles come into it understanding that they have to understand. They have to try and get everybody's point of view before they argue for what they want.
Right, and if they want to get what they want, they need to understand what everybody else is looking for and how can we manage to get these things sort of together. Because, when you think about it, most firstborns, and often the baby of the family, parents will focus a lot on what they want for them and what they want them to be doing. And so often the things that they want and need, they're just going to get automatically. And of course, with the first also, that parents, at least for a period of time, don't have to allocate resources between children. So everything just goes to that one. And I think that in that sense, they don't have to learn that skill in the same way, or at least they don't learn it as early often as the middle children are forced to learn it.
I was interested to read about middle children's commitment to justice, because it's one thing for them to say, I want what's fair for me. But in fact, they're pretty sensitive to what's fair for everybody.
Yes. And I think that part of that comes from that early sense of that things aren't necessarily always fair. When we talk about the resentment that some middle children will feel when they're younger, which I think most of them do grow out of because they realize that they actually benefited from the situation. But when they're little, they just see, I don't get as much time or I don't get as much attention. And it makes them sensitive to other people's feelings of injustice and feeling that they're not being done by in a proper way. And so I think that in general, it tends to create this sense that they want to right wrongs, in a sense. And I think that's one of the reasons, and we talk about in the book, that there are a lot of different people that we call them justice seekers, but people like Nelson Mandela and Susan B. Anthony and Martin Luther King Jr., that, you know, are focused, have been really focused on issues about fairness. Some studies have been done that have looked at just, you know, just the general average undergraduate student in terms of birth order and feelings about justice, and shown that things like the likelihood of supporting, say, for example, employees striking at a workplace where they're not getting, you know, reasonable pay, that you're more likely to see, you know, later-born children, including middle-borns, getting arrested, actually, for, you know, supporting those kinds of causes. And so they're willing to, in a sense, practice what they preach, that they're willing to stand up for the rights of other people.
This research also challenges the idea that anyone who's anyone is a firstborn,
yeah.
which I think a lot of people, maybe a lot of firstborns, have done a lot to sort of profligate.
That may be true.
I think
yeah. Well, and I mean, one of the things is that if you look at academics in general, there are more firstborns than any other birth order. Like if you go to an academic conference and you ask people to put up their hand, you know, are you a firstborn or, you know, middleborns or lastborns? The majority of hands, 80 to 90% at most conferences, the hands are all going up for firstborns.
Hmm.
And you'll get a small percentage of lastborns, and you will get like a little handful of middle children putting up their hands. And one of the things is that a lot of people do research on things they're interested in. And so I suspect that in the case, a lot of past research in birth order has been driven by firstborns who believe that, you know, they were advantaged and that this had, the, you know, these successful results for them, that they were more likely to be presidents and heads of state and doctors and lawyers and all of those sorts of things. I mean, interestingly, one of the sort of most recent prominent books on birth order that was published about, I guess it was back in 96, by Frank Silloway, it was called Born to Rebel, and it was about later-born children, and in particular, last-born children, and driven by a researcher who was a later-born child himself, for a change, not a first-born, doing that kind of research. So I think that certainly may play a part in that, but in fact, you know, the reality is that there are lots of very successful people in the world, often really trailblazing successful people in the world, who were not firstborn children, you know, the Bill Gates, Madonna. I mean, we talk about people like Charles Darwin, whose ideas revolutionized science. These were middle children, and at least in Darwin's case, a rather disappointing to his parents initially middle child. You know, they wanted him to be a doctor, and that wasn't working for him. And okay, well, you can be, you know, you can be a parish chaplain, you know, and that wasn't working for him. And then, you know, he had to beg them to let him go, you know, travel on the Beagle and travel around the world and make the discoveries that he made.
And we don't remember today the names of whoever came before Charles Darwin and his family.
No, we don't really. I mean, some people might remember, you know, the fact that there were other people in his family, but probably not unless they're actually, you know, biologists or scholars of Darwin. And they might remember, you know, his father, uncle, and his brothers and things like that. But no, I mean, he is the one that we remember now because he's the one that really changed the way, you know, science in biology is done. And there's not a class that you would take in that field now where you wouldn't hear about natural selection.
Catherine Salmon is my guest. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Redlands in California and co-author, along with Katrin Schumann, of The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Catherine Salmon. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Redlands and co-author of The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Catherine, before the break, you were telling us about Charles Darwin, famous middleborn, and it makes sense. He perfectly exemplifies what you write about here in that he was open to new ideas and new experiences. That is something that you say really marks middleborn children.
Right. One of the things one of the aspects that people have talked about for a long time in personality research is that there's a great advantage to being open to experience and open to new and novel ideas and to trying different things for children who are not the firstborn. Because the firstborn really, whatever they're best at, that position is open for them. They're the only one there. They get the first choice, right? But as children are born later down in the family, they need to find their own role and their own niche in the family and their own skills. And so being open to experience and being willing to try new things facilitates you finding what you're best at that may be very different from the siblings that have come before you. And so one of the things that has characterized middle children and last born children too in these big personality studies is that they tend to be very open to experience. They tend to be risk takers in that sense as well. And there are real payoffs for that sometimes. Of course, there are also times when it doesn't pay off. There are the people who are successful that we tend to talk about in the book. And some people will take those risks and be open to novel experience that, you know, is not necessarily as helpful in the end. And sometimes you might embrace the new scientific idea and it might be incorrect. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, they still contribute a great deal to our progress because they actually are willing to explore those ideas where other people might not even bother to check them out. And sometimes when you check them out, they're right.
Does the gender balance matter very much in terms of how much the middle child status is felt?
Mm-hmm. It does. I mean, one of the things that is important, and it's differentially important in different cultures, in some cultures it's more important than others, is that parents often invest a lot in the firstborn, but especially the firstborn boy. So there are some situations where you might be the firstborn girl, and if the middle child is a boy, the boy may actually be treated more like the firstborn child, may have more parental investment, more parental attention. And in those cases, sometimes you see interesting kind of role reversals where the first child may have some of the responsibilities that are normally given to firstborn children, but then they don't get as much attention or other kinds of investment, whereas the middle child in that situation might get a lot of investment. And as well, if you have a dynamic where, say, you only had three children, and the middle child was the only one of their gender, that child will tend to get a little bit more investment because, you know, it's the only girl or the only boy. Mm-hmm. So it does make a difference. And usually in studies when people are looking at birth order effects, they'll do a variety of different things statistically to try and control for that. You can also look at families where you only have girls or you only have boys and see how the effects play out as well.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who writes, I am a middle child, and I do find that my family and even professional management roles distill to that of a mediator. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily have an issue with this role, except that I expend all of my energy walking a tightrope over conflict.
I think that can happen. And I think that can be a real challenge for some middles, because middles generally don't like conflict. It's one of the things that, in a sense, also makes them good sort of negotiators and peacemakers. They don't like a lot of conflict. They like to straighten everything out. But they can find that quite stressful, I think, sometimes. They're very good at that kind of job, but when they're constantly being asked to do it, sometimes I think that they can find it not so much challenging, because I think they're quite good at it, but I think they do find it stressful.
Are parents always immediately aware when their middle child, who is, as you described, somewhat conflict avoidant, runs into trouble?
No. I think, unfortunately, I think one of the problems for parents is that partially because they sometimes don't pay as much attention to the middle child and the middle child is more independent and self-sufficient, they may not pick up on cues that things are going wrong. And one of the things that we encourage in the book for parents who are reading it is to make sure that you do talk to the middle child and try and carve out some time that's time for just you and them, to to try and encourage them to form that kind of close relationship with you that they might choose to sort of transfer to their peers a little bit more in the absence of getting that attention from their parents. I think that parents should attend to things with middles when they do really fuss over things, because I think when middles do, it really is important. I think because they're used to not having a lot of attention, they just do for themselves fine. And when they don't do for themselves fine, it may be an indicator that there's something more serious going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Shree in Flower Mound. Hi, Shree.
Hi, Chris. I have a question for your guest. I was skeptical about the comment that you made about the apparent neglect that parents have for the middle child. Now, I'm a middle child myself, and while all the characteristics that you listed were surprisingly similar, I don't think that was because my parents neglected me. On the other hand, I was the child that did everything right. I was obedient, and I did the right thing. I took on more responsibility, duties, but that was only because they entrusted me with more responsibility than they did the others. And I always used to think that that's why I turned out this way. I agree completely with what you said about conflict resolution. I see that at my workplace. Unfortunately, sometimes that comes at a cost.
Sure.
Where I certainly give in, you know, some of my own ground in order to ensure that
sure.
the others are happy.
What do you think about that, Catherine?
Well, I think that it certainly is the case. I mean, just saying that, you know, that middleborns may be overlooked or neglected more by their parents, receive less parental attention, doesn't mean that every middle child is going to receive less attention. And in the caller's case, it may be that parents saw her as being more responsible, gave her responsibilities, and let her be independent, in a sense, by giving her these responsibilities, as opposed to just because they weren't paying attention to her. Most of the research that looks at the parental attention thing, which, you know, we may call it neglect, but it's not like they lock them in a room and don't feed them. But it's more the case that if you look at big studies that sort of track things like how much money parents give their kid towards their kids' college education, how much actual time they spend with the children, measures like that, you actually see, if you have a big enough sample, that the middle children get less. So, like, for example, I had a study that was done in Vancouver when I was a professor there, and we looked at how much money kids were receiving as spending money while they were at college. And middle children received less. They just received less spending money, unless they were a firstborn boy, and then they did not. Then they received more than everybody else. So there's studies like that. There was a study done a number of years ago that looked at college tuition, the amount of money that parents actually gave for their kids' college tuition, and they gave less to the middle children. Now, there are a number of factors that can contribute to that, too, including how many children you have. And, of course, if you have multiples at the same time and they're all going to school, everybody should be theoretically losing out to the same extent. But it does seem like there's a greater disadvantage in those cases to the middle child. But it doesn't mean that every middle child is going to experience that. There may be times when the middle child might be the parent's favorite for some particular reason. Maybe the child's more like them than the other children in the family, and they'll get more attention. So it's never the case that it explains every single child.
So as the wife of a middle-born child, I was delighted to read the section about middle-borns as life partners, because they tend to be really good.
They do. And people who study relationship satisfaction and marital satisfaction report that, you know, they tend to have very happy marriages. They tend to be less likely to get divorced. So they seem to see it as a real commitment in a way that sometimes is greater than that experienced by other birth orders. And I think part of that develops out of the whole, you know, sort of social orientation, altruistic orientation that comes from depending so much on peers. I mean, your partner is a peer, a special kind of peer, but that's still a peer. And so I think because they value those relationships so much, they tend to be less likely to do things that threaten them. And I had done a study a couple of years ago that looked at people's infidelity, people's sexual infidelity, and the middle children were the least likely to cheat on their partners in the study. So, yeah, when I went, you know, dating for a while after that, I was asking everybody, what birth order are you?
Just make note of that as you go along.
Yep.
So if middle children are somewhat more independent from their families as they grow up, how does that translate to their adult relationships to their parents and to their siblings?
Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, in some ways, I think they have very good relationships with their siblings as adults. The studies that I had done that looked at things like that, the relationships to the siblings, actually don't show as much resentment as a lot of people, I think, assume will be there. They don't seem to have a lot. They seem to be quite attached to their siblings. In some cases, as adults, they sort of recognize, you know, the sort of challenges that their parents may have faced with multiple children in the family, and they seem to, if they had any childhood resentment left, they seem to let it go. But there are some who don't have as close relationships with their parents as, say, the baby of the family might have. So I think, you know, there's certainly some evidence that they may not have as close relationships to the parents unless both sides have made an effort mm-hmm. towards that. But it doesn't seem to negatively impact the relationships with their siblings very much. And in terms of their own families, they seem to be very family-oriented. The majority of them are quite open about the fact that they always wanted to have a family of their own. They always wanted to have children. And they seem to be very invested often in trying to treat their children very equitably, mm-hmm. perhaps because they saw those differences for themselves. Although they don't always do that. Sometimes they overcompensate with their own middle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones next to Jackie in Dallas. Hey, Jackie.
Hi. My question was in regards to siblings, like multiples, like twins and triplets, and if you did any studies with that.
I myself have not, I've never had a triplet set participate in the study, but I haven't included twins in my own studies because they do kind of complicate matters. We talk a little bit about that in the book and the fact, like, what happens, say, for example, if twins are the middleborns in the family. And they're not like typical middleborns when that happens, of course, because twins are very special. Typically, in most families, you only have one set of twins, and everybody gives them a lot of attention. So in many ways, twins end up being a lot more like only children, like having a pair of onlys, in a sense. Regardless of how many other siblings they have, because they get so much often attention and investment. But for people who are interested in twin research in general, I'd highly recommend books that are written in the research that's been done by Nancy Siegel. She's a twin researcher that originally started with the famous Minnesota Twins Project, where they looked at twins who were reared together versus reared apart to look at some of those effects of growing up in the same family versus, you know, not growing up in the same family and the role that genetics plays in that as well. She's done some really good work.
Is it really called the Minnesota Twins Project?
Yes, it was called the Minnesota Twins Project. And it started years ago. She was a student when she was first involved in it, I think, a graduate student. And she still continued to work with some of that group. But they made a point of going around trying to find twins who were adopted out, for example, and looking at their personalities and how similar or different they were, and had often talked about how twins reared apart in some ways were more similar than twins reared together. Because when they're reared together, they do try and individualize and become somewhat different from each other as they grow up, whereas if they're raised in different families, they don't have that same sort of pressure to be different from their twin. And there's all sorts of, you know, entertaining anecdotal stories about them marrying women with the same name and calling their dogs the same things and having the same bad habits and things like that.
So tell us a little bit more about what you learned about middle children as parents themselves. You mentioned sometimes they sort of overcompensate with their own middle child. And you found that they're an interesting combination often of authoritative
and permissive.
Permissive, thank you, yes.
Yes, yeah. I mean, one of the things is we wondered, you know, because we really hadn't been able to, when we were first working on the book, we hadn't been able to find any studies really looking at how birth order affected parenting style. And so we did one where we had a number of people participating where they were filling out questions about that measure parenting style and asking them about their own birth order and their own rearing experiences. And we sort of went into it with the idea that, you know, middleborns would be, you know, sort of following the kind of standard thing, right? That firstborns are really authoritarian. They want to rule the roost and keep the rules this way. And that the babies of the family will be super permissive and that middles will be somewhere in between. We were thinking they'll be the happy ideal medium. and in a sense, they are, but in a sense, we didn't get quite the results that we were expecting. So they certainly are less authoritarian than firstborns. But bizarrely to us, they're more permissive than the lastborns were. So we were kind of surprised by that because we thought, well, like, you'd expect the baby of the family in many ways to be the most permissive. But in fact, the baby of the family kind of seemed to, when they were parents, want things their own way.
Yeah.
So they might not value rules for their own sake in the way that some firstborns do, but they did want their rules followed. And middleborns were more, they saw the value of rules, but they also saw more value in the negotiation of the rules with the children. So they were permissive to a certain extent. And then they sort of did have a line that they would draw at the end. But they ended up being a really interesting mix of the, you know, authoritarian aspect of things with the permissive. So they scored high on, in a sense, on multiple things. And that may, in fact, actually be a real positive thing in terms of parenting. But it seemed like their own experiences of having sort of hands-off parenting where the parents weren't that controlling translated into them thinking, well, it's actually probably a good thing to not be too over-controlling of the children. So they tended to give more freedom.
Yeah, I wonder if it speaks to a kind of flexibility in parenting.
It may. I mean, they seem to be, one of the ways that I've talked about is they seem to follow more of the free-range parenting style. That you need to let them do their own thing as long as they're not doing crazy things, and give them the freedom to learn and make their own choices, because that's what has helped them, in a sense, and that by the time they're parents, they actually recognize that. They may not have recognized it as children, but as adults, they see that, you know, they're capable of dealing with all these different situations because of the experiences they have.
Catherine Salmon is my guest. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Redlands in California. She's also co-author, along with Catherine Schumann, of The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Professor at the University of Redlands in California, Catherine Salmon. Her new book is called The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. The book is now available in a paperback edition as well. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Ryan in Fort Worth. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. So I'm one of four children, and I was born number three. So who's the middle child of those four?
It's really you and your older sibling. So most of us would consider two and three in your family to be middle children. Are you all the same sex, or were some boys, some girls?
So I have two older brothers and one younger sister. My second question, the second part of the question is about the fact that my two older brothers were born a decade before my sister and I.
Yeah.
And so what impact does that have on middle childness? I'll take the answer off here.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, yeah, that actually does make a big difference sometimes. So when you have substantial birth spacing, so once you get to like 5, 6, 7 years between either two siblings or between groups of siblings, it really does dilute the birth order effects to a great extent. And so in his case, it might be that the second collection of kids, so he and his younger sister, in a sense are more like a second set of just two kids with a first and a last. And the same especially for the older siblings, because that second sibling from the first one, so 10 years between him and his next sibling, his personality will be largely set by the time that next sibling came along. So he spent 10 years, basically, as the baby of the family. So he's really going to stay the baby of the family in terms of personality. And then that next group that came along, you'll see a little bit more of a firstborn-type personality probably from that, in that particular family, the third boy.
Do you think the significance of middle child status will change now that so many fewer families are having three or more kids than used to, even when I was a kid?
Yeah, I actually think of it as in some ways as being a, one of the sort of negatives of small family size, because I think some of the traits that we talk about a lot in the book, the trailblazing and you know, the justice seeking, I worry that some of those traits, that there'll just be less people really epitomize them because they're growing up in very different circumstances and they're not learning some of those same skills in the same way. And I think parents need to actually be very active about doing more things to create situations where their children are going to learn some of the skills that they otherwise would have just naturally learned at home. That there's more of a focus on doing that. And we've worried about that in the past. People have talked about that a lot with regards to only children, right? That growing up as an only child makes you different and it's more problematic. And I think in some ways it's problematic for any situation where you just don't have very many kids in the home. Because I think, you know, if you've got a whole bunch of kids, you know, my parents' generation, lots of people came from families of like eight. You know, my mom was first of eight children.
My mom was second of 15.
Yeah. I mean, those are very different kinds of circumstances to grow up in, and they foster different traits and skills. They don't think that it's as easy to do them. I think you can do them, but I don't think it's as easy to do them sometimes. You have to work a lot harder to do it in smaller families. So I do sometimes worry about that. It was interesting. I was talking with someone about the election the other day, and I was saying, what we really need is we need a middle child running in this election. Because one of the bizarre things is that we have, it's kind of funny because people a lot of times will talk about how, you know, firstborns tend to have more conservative values and laterborn children tend to have less conservative values. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that in this election we have a firstborn running for the Democratic Party, and a baby of the family running for the Republican Party. And in a sense, it pushes sort of both of them towards the middle, but, you know, in the sense that they're a little bit, you know, that they're a little bit at the less extreme view for their own particular party. But I do think that in some way, if you actually want to get, you know, the government to actually get together and do anything, you need a few more middle children in there and a few less people who may not have the negotiation skills.
That might be the next big campaign push. Who knows?
Yeah, there you go.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with AJ in Dallas. Hi, AJ.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
My question for your guest is, I wonder if your research showed any information regarding birth order and the sexual orientation of children. And I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. My own research, I've not looked at that, but I am very familiar with some of the research that's been done looking at it. And the main result that people talk about is work that, let's see if I can remember, originally I think most of the people who worked on it were part of Ray Blanchard's research group, but they have what they call the fraternal birth order effect. And what it suggests from the studies that they've done is that the more older brothers a younger born boy has, the more likely his sexual orientation is to be homosexual rather than heterosexual.
Hmm.
Now, why that happens, the effect is very clear. It's there. It doesn't account, obviously, for all people who are homosexual in orientation or even all men who are homosexual in orientation. It accounts for a small but significant proportion, probably, of them. But it's not exactly clear why it happens from a mechanism standpoint. There's a lot of theories that somehow there are immune system changes or biological changes in the mother that happen with successive males being born that make for a uterine environment that somehow, you know, either feminizes or fails to masculinize the fetus in certain ways. And so instead of producing a little boy who's going to grow up and find girls attractive, it produces a little boy who's going to grow up and find men attractive. Why it would do things that way is a little bit unclear, but there is that effect, and there is no effect for sexual orientation in women. The effect's only found in studies in men. So there is a series of studies that have been done demonstrating it called the fraternal birth order effect studies.
Email here from Leslie in Duncanville asks about research done on middle children in families where the firstborn has special needs.
Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of work that's been done looking at that. And generally what happens is that in many cases, the middle child is treated more like a first child in those circumstances, depending, of course, on what the special needs issues may be.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, parents invest hugely in what their firstborn is going to do. They have all these expectations for what they're going to do for a living, for the children they'll have, for all of these things. And when you have a special needs child, that changes the game. You're not necessarily going to have, you may have expectations for them, and there may be things you want them to do and that you're going to help them do, but they may not be the same as they would have been if they didn't have those needs. And so oftentimes, some of the weight that normally is given to the first child in terms of these are the things we want you to achieve, you know, you're going to be our first doctor or whatever, those end up going to the middle child. And depending on the age at which that happens, that sort of influences. So if the special needs child, the firstborn was born that way, it's a little bit different than if something happens when they're older that changes the game. They're paralyzed in an accident or something like that, in which case the expectations, you know, may change, but the attention people got when they were young that may have shaped their personality may not, of course, have happened in a way that would create differences between the sort of actual birth order and then what you see in terms of the sort of anticipated effects. So really a lot of it depends, I think, on the age at which that sort of thing happens. If born special needs, usually, obviously that child always needs more attention, and so they may get the attention that a firstborn would normally get, but the expectations and the desires for achievement are often transferred to the middle child. So there's a lot more parental influence on their choices.
Obviously, Catherine, there are a million factors that play into parents' decisions about how many children to have and when to have them. Has anyone in your line of study ever gone so far as to say the ideal number of children is?
No, you know, people really don't. I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, some people now say the ideal number of children is, you know, one.
Some say
or,
none.
You know, or two, depending, of course, on other factors, right? Things like, okay, do you want to increase your population size? Do you want to replace people? Mm-hmm. Do you want to increase the population size? And so, you know, there's a lot of different things that people might be trying to achieve with the number of children. For farming communities, big families were always a good thing because everybody needed to help around the farm. Urban families have tended to have smaller numbers of children often historically. And higher socioeconomic status families often have less children but invest very highly in them.
Mm-hmm.
Lower socioeconomic status families often have more children. And so I think the ideal number of children probably depends a lot on the individual circumstances of the family. I mean, I think having siblings generally is a good thing for children for a variety of reasons, including the fact that your siblings, even though sometimes there's a lot of competition between siblings, I mean, they're also a great ally, you know, and, you know, family is family. And so I think that there's value in that. But I think a lot of it really depends on what parents can actually manage. And so some parents might be able to adequately parent one child.
Mm-hmm.
Some parents might be able to adequately parent three or four children. And that's probably the better sort of barometer is how much, you know, if you're both working full time, having four children close together is going to be a real challenge for you. I think, you know, it's those kinds of factors that parents should probably attend to. But no, I'm not familiar with anybody who's done a study where mathematically they've calculated that this is the ideal number of children to have.
Well, you'd have a lot of enemies no matter what, I guess, if you were to make a determination on that.
It's true. It's true.
Let's take one last call, 1-800-933-5372. We have Rebecca on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Rebecca.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm wondering if this might be tied to my being a middle child, but I feel like I just have this need sometimes to, I feel like, fix everyone's problems. It could be a coworker who maybe she's having a childcare issue, And rather than just listening or making a suggestion or two, I feel like I have to fix it. Is that something that stems from being a middle child, and is there a better way to use that energy?
I think being a middle child certainly can affect that, because I think one of the things about middle children, you know, having peacemaker skills is that they like to keep the peace. They like things to be on an even keel. And so when everything's disruptive for them or for other people, I think there is a natural tendency to want to fix it. Although I will also say that many women generally feel that way too. There's a, that I don't think you'd find that in middle-born men as much as you'll find it in middle-born women. So I think part of that is that I think many women, you know, hate seeing other people having difficulty. Part of it is the empathy. I mean, and women do tend to be somewhat more empathetic, that you don't want other people to be having hard times, and so you want to try and fix it. And I think that in combination with the empathy and the peacemaking and the desire for peace that middles often have, it probably does sort of collect together to make that sometimes more of an issue for middles than it might be for some other birth orders. In terms of trying to manage it, you know, I think that's one of the things that you know, sometimes it's good to help other people out, and that will be wanted, and sometimes people won't necessarily benefit from it, because sometimes people do have to sort of sort their own things out and learn from their own mistakes. But I certainly think that it wouldn't be unexpected for middle children, and especially middle girls, to feel like they want to help other people sort out their problems.
So what do you say to moms and dads raising middle children who want to do right by them but may not have had the experience of being a middle child themselves?
I think there are a couple different things. I mean, I think one of them is that it's good to, because middle children may get a little bit less investment and a little bit less attention, when they are successful at things, it's good to make a big deal out of it, because everybody makes a big deal usually out of the firstborn things, because they're the only one around at the time.
There's 1,000 pictures, right?
It's special. Yeah, exactly. And the baby gets a lot of, oh, they're so cute, and, you know, attention. And so it's good to remember to call out the achievements of your middle child when they have them, and never compare them to their siblings. That never ends well.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, I mean, they're unique, right? Mm-hmm. All of the children are unique. And so if you say, oh, why can't you be more like your older brother? They're going to be the opposite. They are going to go the opposite way. And you have to realize that, you know, the part of the point is that all of your children are going to be very different. You're not producing clones that are going out into the world. They're all going to have unique skills, and they need to be different to succeed in different areas.
Catherine Salmon's book is called The Secret Power of Middle Children, How Middleborns Can Harness Their Unexpected and Remarkable Abilities. The book's out now in paperback. Catherine, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free every day at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.